Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I always used to tell people, if you get a name for yourself, the money comes, so you don't have to worry about that. I found out since there's a little problem with that logic.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
I don't want to die at James Franco's house.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
Your relationships are the heaviest components in your life.
And need to talk about more.
It's a matter of money.
I'm Anna Sale. Singer-songwriter Robert Earl Keane has been with his wife Kathleen for 30 years.
When we first got married and we were living in Nashville, this woman said, I gave you 6 months, you know. And I said, you know, you don't know me. It's not like that for me.
That tenacity to stick things out and hold on even when they get hard has served Robert Earl Keane well over the years, in family and in his career, in part because his story songs never really found a home on country radio.
I'm truly an outlier. There's no other way to describe me but a true outlier. It allows me a great deal of freedom. At the same time, there's a great deal of frustration of not being able to, you know, fit in the country club sometimes.
He's made his career by steady touring. At 59 years old, he still plays about 120 shows a year and tends to his loyal fan base that started in his home state of Texas and spread. His fans love him. His hair and beard are now flecked with gray, but every concert I've been to feels like a party. First, there's the chanting. Then Robert Earl Keane strides out on stage in jeans and a cowboy hat, or in a sharp suit if he's playing bluegrass standards, and everyone just goes bonkers. But before all this, Robert Earl Keane's music career had a slow start when he was a young husband with a new wife.
We laughingly say that our first 12 years of marriage were rounds, you know. Yeah, we went through 12 rounds of marriage, and then, you know, it got better. So yeah, but, you know, it's tough on anybody's marriage when you're struggling so hard to make something work, and there's that anxiety, and there's that fear going on, you know.
What would you argue about?
Well, the classic things, the money, the career, the direction you're going, the maybe we should try something different. I mean, my heart was always completely fixed in the idea of, you know, making a career out of music. So I couldn't get off of that. So any time that would be hinted to me, I was pretty testy about that kind of thing. And, you know, even if she'd say, well, maybe you ought to try this or something, like, I don't need to try that. I'm doing the right thing, you know. But I just wasn't having any success at it.
Robert and Kathleen moved to Nashville from Texas in 1985. He'd just released his first album, called No Kind of Dancer, and his friend, the musician Steve Earle, told him if he wanted to make it big, he needed to go to Tennessee.
It was exciting and scary for me. I was somewhat secretive about it because all the way through college, I was always playing and always thinking, this is what I want to do, but I wasn't telling anybody because I didn't want to, you know, fall on my face and embarrass myself, but I was always playing. And so when I finally made a record, I felt like, you know, I had made this giant leap into, you know, semi-adulthood in that I've done something on my own. Mm-hmm. And when I moved to Nashville, that was a true leap of faith. I had never even considered it. I never considered the real roadmap to fame. I just thought that you would want it bad enough you could figure it out, you know. So I'd never thought about, oh, here's what normal people do. They go to Nashville and learn how to be a songwriter. And I had absolutely no vision of, you know, what the music business or the entertainment business was about.
Did you feel like everybody else around you sort of did?
Well, I love that quote in that movie Diner where Mickey Rourke says, "Do you get the feeling that there's something going on that we don't know about here?" And I always related to that comment because I do get the feeling to this day that there's something that I just not clued in on. And, you know, some of that bliss is really healthy as far as I'm concerned, because you can work yourself to death trying to figure out all the angles, you know. But I do have kind of a one mantra. It's brute force and ignorance. Just keep pushing, you know.
Brute force and ignorance.
Yeah, right.
The sun is setting on our time living here. You've lost the will, I've lost the heart. We should be leaving while the coast is still clear, 'cause we won't make it after dark. Cashing our chips and we can pack up the car, lock up the door and hide the key. The only two things that mean anything to me are loving you and leaving Tennessee.
My stint in Nashville, which lasted 22 months, was difficult. I moved there with some friends. All my peers that were musicians blew up. I mean, they completely blew up, and I went the other way. I just kept sliding further and further away from my goal, and I didn't know what was wrong, and I didn't know what I was doing wrong. And I was, you know, hitting the streets and knocking on doors and trying to get some attention. And it just wasn't happening. So by the end, I was standing outside. I'd come back from Lawrence, Kansas, where I had played, and my car broke down. And I spent all the money that we had made in Lawrence. And my wife was with me. And I got home and someone had broken our house, and we had, like, I don't know, a couple little cabinets and a couple of trinkets or something, and a VCR and a television, and they took all of it. And I thought, well, this is a sign, you know, this is a sign. There was another, more of a funny thing. While I was broken down on the road in O'Fallon, Missouri, Steve Earle, who had talked me into coming to Nashville's bus, passed by. Big, huge bus goes whooshing by, says Steve Earle on the side, and I thought, this is not really good. And I got back, and our house is ransacked, and I felt ashamed and humiliated, and at the same time felt like I had to make some kind of move to just change the way things were. So I turned to Kathleen, and I said, "You ready to go home?" She said, "I'm ready." I said, "Okay, let's go."
So we went. So it sounds like it wasn't so much like not having the money in Nashville. It was just feeling totally spiritually depleted.
Yeah, well, I was broke too. I had hawked everything that I had hawked. I was completely broke. It was, you know, it was all of it at one time. It was. But the part where I was making no inroads whatsoever, and I wasn't even writing good stuff. I was, you know, deflated and somewhat embarrassed that, you know, I mean, a lot of my friends knew that I'd gone up there, and I thought that I would come back with the prize, and instead I came back with my tail between my legs. And my whole reemergence was somewhat slow, but, you know, when I had the nerve to open up the guitar case and start strumming on the guitar, I realized, oh, I don't have to write a hit song. I can write what I want to write, and I did.
Standing on Main Street across from Mr. Blues, in my faded leather jacket, my weathered broken shoes. A chill north wind was blowing, but the spring was coming on, as I wanted to myself, just how long have been gone. So I strolled across on Main Street, walked down a flight of stairs, stepped into the honky-tonk, all my friends were there. And the outside was flashing, welcome, come on in. It feels so good, feeling good again.
What was the decision like to start a family with your wife? You've been married for a while.
For a while, and that had to do with we were struggling so much. My thing was I have got to make this work. I've got to get this career off the ground. It's so weird to call music a career because it's not exactly that. It's almost a complete lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So I had to get this off the ground and feel like I could be responsible for, for a family, and I wasn't going to leave them in a lurch or try to figure out something else. I did feel like I had to be able to handle it financially as well as psychologically. And the first, several years that we were married, I wasn't ready at all. It would all come unraveled.
Was there something that made you feel ready?
Yeah, played a night one time. I played a couple of shows where they totally sold out, and I thought, I got something going. I think I had a couple of records under my belt at that point, and I didn't have a plan, but I did think I had something going. I had the wheels in motion. So at that point, I felt more comfortable, and that's when shortly thereafter, Claire was born.
And your wife previously would tour with you on the road, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I never did any of that nonsense about, having her sell merch or, glad handing people and stuff like that. We enjoyed each other's company and we had a really good time. And, it was like Kerouac's on the road sort of thing. It was this great, Travels with Charlie experience. It was really fun. Travels with Kathleen. It was really good.
She pulls back on Main Street in her new Mercedes Benz. The road goes on forever and the party never ends.
Coming up, Robert O'Keefe talks about life on the road over the past two decades, including the many nights of partying and drinking.
All things in moderation, including moderation.
Do you still drink?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I'm alive at this point. All the AA people out there probably go, oh, this guy's totally in denial. But the fact is I've never had the problem with it. There was probably a time, I don't know, 20 years ago, it was a little tougher, and I was probably pushing it too hard. But these days, it's very, very United Methodist Church kind of drinking.
Our episode about Heidi Reinberg returning to Brooklyn stirred some passionate responses from you. This came in from Michelle Fogarty in Vernon, Connecticut.
When you asked her about being ready for retirement, she basically said, oh, I don't need to worry about it because someday I'll have family money. And I have a friend with a similar attitude, and it absolutely enrages me that they live their entire adult life being financially insecure because someday their parents are going to die and give them money.
Others wrote in that they were frustrated that Heidi hadn't changed more in the year after getting priced out of her neighborhood. But some of you heard a story that felt very familiar. SR wrote on deathsexmoney.org, "Thank you for sharing your story, Heidi. I also experienced near destitution recently, but I was helped by friends. And as I looked back on my worst year in terms of finances, I was surprised to discover that I considered it a good one." Speaking of money, I really do appreciate the donations you've been sending in to support Death, Sex, and Money. It's incredible. You get this show for free, and you're voluntarily pitching in your hard-earned dollars to help us make more shows. It means a lot. If you've been meaning to give but haven't done it yet, please go to deathsexmoney.org/donate and make a contribution at any level, and we'll thank you with that new Death, Sex, and Money sticker. Also, if you live in Portland, Oregon, I'm coming to town on May 30th to be on Live Wire with Luke Burbank. Info about that show is at livewireradio.org. The show's at 7:30 at night, but if you're in the area and want to get together for an afternoon activity, send me an email at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. We're cooking up something fun. On the next episode, hear what happened when we were live on stage in Brooklyn. Designer and potter Jonathan Adler was there with his husband, Simon Doonan, the writer and creative ambassador for Barney's New York. They talked about their 20-year relationship and their 14-year age difference.
I think the reason our relationship works is because he's so technologically tragic that I am in complete control of the remote and the radio, and
yeah,
it just works.
Away on some trip to Peru or wherever, I just sort of sit in darkness with the dog. Like, it's very poignant. It is.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. For the past 20 years, Robert Earl Keen has spent half the year on the road. This summer, he's booked up solid from May through September. Traveling with him are the guys in his band, many of whom have been with him for a long time.
I've made a commitment to my band. My band is paid. They're you know, paid like anyone else in the world on a salary. I have a retirement program that I've had for 20 years now.
Really?
We have insurance, which we've had for 10 years now. And we take a month off every year. So I decided to treat the music business like people treat their own businesses and try to just follow that model. It was simple. To me, it was simple because that's what you should do for people. They give you their lives, basically, and you need to make sure that you're not going to steer them down the wrong path or leave them in a lurch. So I'm very passionate about that. I can't do what the musicians around me do. They have this incredible talent, and you know, there's a handful of people that really, really appreciate how hard they work, how much they do. I wouldn't inflict the rigors of the road on my worst enemy. I would, because they're just, you know, it's there's a lot of weight, and fortunately for us, I have a great band and a great bunch of guys. There used to be a time where, you'd finish the show and then, you know, there's about the after party and stuff. And that just doesn't happen very much anymore. At one point, I did think the drinking in the whole group was sort of over the top, or was getting that way. So I started ordering these pizzas so everybody'd have something to eat and maybe slow that down a little bit. And now it's like, I think we look forward to the pizza more than we do the beer.
There's something about being at your shows, when you look around, when you see grown men fist pumping in the air and singing along with tears streaming down their eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's something about, like, your songs, many of them sort of allude to this intimacy with melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
But your songs are joyful.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there something about that in your real life, like, where you figured out how to be in a good mood despite sadness?
Well, I do. I feel like, you know, in general that life is good. And I'm so always, even to this day, somewhat surprised when, you know, you just get a tsunami of, you know, bad news or hard times. And I do think it's always, you know, there's a, you know, a brighter sunset coming on. So that's the way I think. Also, just to kind of, you know, drag on in some incredibly sad fashion, I don't want to bore people, because you know, the performer in me wants to always make sure that, you know, you go away with some kind of good feeling. Yeah.
Part of what comes with that is feeling adored,
mm-hmm,
by your fans,
mm-hmm,
which for a lot of musicians also means by women.
Mm-hmm.
How have you navigated that as a traveling musician?
You know, I have a great bunch of people around me. We're all like-minded in that way. It's not, You know, that's the kind of the unsexy, you know, like, oh, I don't want to hear that. You know, I want to hear these, you know, crazy rock stories and stuff. But, you know, really and truly, we're a bunch of guys that go out and play music, and then we get on the bus and we play Scrabble. And, and occasionally there's the late night party or there's the bar or something stuff. But you just get up and you walk away. I mean, because that's such a side road to what, you know, the purpose is. The purpose is to get out and play music and put these songs across, make people happy, come home to your family and take care of your family. And those are the things that are most important to me. So I don't really veer. That doesn't mean that I don't like women or there's not some, you know, great feeling of, you know, in this nice that all these people like me and I've been, pinned to the wall as, you know, being flirtatious and stuff. But to me, it's just all fun. It's not about crossing the line or figuring out something else. I don't have another agenda.
I'm coming home. Made up my mind, that's what I'm gonna do. Can't love nobody on the telephone. I'm coming home to you.
Do you think the distance, like having some time apart over your long marriage, has had any benefits?
I think it has a lot of benefits. In the world of what the divorce rate is at 50% or a little bit over 50% these days, I think a lot of it is just, you know, being, you know, too close quarters or not being able to figure out how to handle that time away from your spouse. And we've been, you know, very dogged about our effort in trying to make sure that works. So I would have to say yes.
Which of the two of you is more concerned about stability?
Me, I'm definitely. She has her thing that she likes routine and things like that. But I'm always thinking in terms of making sure that we're covered, that the girls are fine, that my band is, you know, covered. That's high on the list.
And on sex, is sex, compare for me sex in your 50s versus your 40s.
Wow, I wish I were a clever person at this point and I could say something really funny. I don't know. I think sex is a huge driving force in your life. And to be honest, I would say that somewhere in your 50s, you lose some of that drive, and it is somewhat devastating. It is as much as losing a loved one somehow.
Because it makes you feel you're aging.
There's the aging part, but the other thing is a certain amount of fatigue, and then a certain amount of losing connection with the world around you. Keep getting where you are used to people looking at you, and then all of a sudden realizing you're just invisible. That's part of it. It's that loss of whatever we have in our hormonal makeup that I think that makes you invisible, and it's rough.
You should think of it as like a part of a pulse and an energy that's happening around you that you feel more alienated from. I've never thought of it like that.
Absolutely. It's if it were a movie or something, you would all of a sudden be a halftone instead of a full tone. You would be starting to become invisible, and I think that's the main ingredient right there. Hopefully what you do is you work on your intellect. I don't know. I can't grow old gracefully. I damn sure can't figure that one out.
Robert Earl Keen. He's playing shows across the American South and West this summer. Tour dates are at roberterlkeen.com. His latest album, Happy Prisoner, is a great collection of bluegrass songs that also features Peter Rowan, Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks, and Lyle Lovett, Robert's old college buddy from Texas A&M. Death, Sex, and Money is a production of WNYC. The team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, James Ramsey, and Joe Ford. Thank you to our fantastic interns, Zachary Mack and Caitlin Pierce. Best of luck to you in your next adventures. The Reverend John DeLore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money. And don't forget, we want to give you a Death, Sex, and Money sticker, so please pledge your support at any level at deathsexmoney.org/donate. And Robert O'Keefe's music is hard to pin down. It's country, folk, bluegrass, blues. But when I asked him how he thinks about death, it was all rock and roll.
My plan, a donkey, two big wooden boxes on the donkey, you know, like saddlebags, right? Full of heroin, put me into the desert and let me go out into the desert, and then, you know, you can find my bones in about 30 years. I always heard it was good, so why not, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to go read a Nicholas Sparks book, that's for damn sure.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.